From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Britain's highly anticipated general election on Thursday resulted in a massive victory for the Tories, who captured well over the majority they needed in Parliament to push through the Brexit deal that they want. The Labour Party, which had taken a nuanced approach to Brexit, won just over 200 seats out of 650, leading party leader Jeremy Corbyn to announce he's stepping down. Just days ago, leftist analysts were predicting a progressive win, with Corbyn's promises of protecting healthcare and expanding social services. What happened? Joining me to make sense of the vote and to discuss his latest book is Richard Wolff, visiting professor at the New School University in New York, a professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, and Understanding Marxism. He also hosts Economic Update, and his new book is called Understanding Socialism. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you, Sonali. Glad to be here.
So this idea of socialism, of course, very much on people's minds, not just in terms of the US election, but the election that just took place in Britain. And Jeremy Corbyn, who was vowing to protect Britain's very successful socialized medical system, was going further and actually, you know, talking about social services in such a way that media were casting it as a redistribution of wealth. What happened on Thursday?
Well, I think the basic lesson that I draw from the British election is a kind of sad comment on what is happening really to Western capitalism, not just in Britain, very similarly here in the United States. So I think it's quite worthwhile to take a look at it. The real factor shaping modern politics in both Britain and the United States is the crisis of capitalism back in 2008, the second worst crash in the history of the capitalist system, second only to the Great Depression. It proved that the mechanisms to manage capitalist economies are not adequate to avoiding such crashes as they had been promised to be. It dealt a devastating blow. Real wages in the United States have gone nowhere since 2008, and they've gone down in Britain, making the working class have to look not only at a collapse of capitalism, not only at the government bailing out the very corporations and rich who brought that collapse with their financial maneuvers, but then finally the austerity imposed afterwards that makes the mass of people pay for the bailouts of the people who should have been punished rather than bailed out. I mean, you put all that together, and of course, it's a crisis of the mentality, of the feelings, and everything else. So it was clear to anyone who paid attention to this that capitalism was going to have a really bad 10 years from 2008 or 9 to the present, because people would be rightly angry and bitter about what had been done to them by this unstable system in its latest meltdown. That meant that the political leaders, the people responsible to corporate capitalism, Trump in the United States, Johnson in Britain, they had a clear task which has faced capitalism in the past. When the system breaks down and dysfunctions, you must find something other than the system to blame. And in both countries, nationalism proved once again to be the card to play. In the United States, we have a leader who thinks that putting immigrant children in cages is an appropriate response, who speaks of desperate poor people coming into the country, as they always have, as an invasion of rapists and criminals, etc., who deals with every foreign country, even the placid Canadians, as if they were cheaters and manipulators. And he's going to protect all Americans from this, here we go, onslaught of foreigners. Turn to Boris Johnson, same game. This time it's immigrants and the Europeans, etc., etc., be angry at them. The sad reality is it worked. It gave the mass of people angry, bitter, and wanting something to be done to stop or reverse their suffering, something to focus on.
But why wasn't Jeremy Corbyn's promise for a better life enough to overcome that dystopia and that fear-mongering that the right promised? Did the smear job about him as anti-Semitic have something to do with it? There was an article in the New York Times, Brett Stephen, op-ed writer, who said, this was a day before the election, a vote for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party is a vote for anti-Semitism. This is the New York Times.
Yes, the New York Times, you know, should be ashamed of itself. I don't think the anti-Semitism charge, which basically came from the Tony Blair wing of the Labour Party and was meant to stumble Jeremy Corbyn, had all that much effect. The mass of people, particularly in the Labour Party in the north of England, who changed their vote and brought the Tories this victory, they weren't moved one way or the other by the charge of anti-Semitism. They were moved by this simple fact. You're going to do something about Brexit. Brexit has been the issue. The foreigner is the problem. We're going to cut away from Europe, and that's going to be a better situation for you and me than anything. When Jeremy Corbyn tried correctly to say that he's represents the defense of the healthcare system and other social benefits, he is facing a problem that existed long before he took over. The failure of the Labour Party to systematically, over the last 50 years, be a party that attacks capitalism for the system that it is, for the failure that it is, for the Tories as the servants of that system, and therefore the need for fundamental change. When Jeremy waffled, not as bad as his predecessor, Tony Blair, but when he waffled, he's going to reform this and reform that, then you begin to sound like you're ambivalent between system change, which is the card to play, or you're going to fix it. But these efforts to fix it have been promised to the American and British working class for decades, and nothing fundamental changes. And I think the Brexit is a clear act. They're going to break from Europe. And so there's a hope that maybe that will work. And let me underscore, nothing fundamental will change. To put the Tories in charge, they will take care of the capitalist class in England, whether it is in Europe or whether it's out of Europe. Just like Mr. Trump and the GOP will take care of big business in the United States with immigration, without immigration, with NAFTA, without NAFTA, focusing on these details doesn't deal with the problem, and the problem is the system.
Right. Gary Young, writing for The Guardian, pointed out that Boris Johnson's simple message, get Brexit done, resonated with voters, and that it was a mistake for Corbyn to not take a clear stand on it. They basically, you know, said it was more of a we'll deal with it later, and then left open the door for a potential second Brexit referendum. I'm almost wondering if Brits are so tired of the Brexit saga, they want it to be done. And Johnson's decisiveness sounded tempting. And also then there's the issue of the Scottish National Party, SNP, that won more seats, and it may end up breaking off in order to remain in the EU. So your last thoughts before we get to your book on these two aspects of the election.
I think you're right, but more than the waffling of Jeremy on the question of Brexit, is the greater problem of the waffling of the Labour Party. Are you going to be a socialist party that says we can do better than capitalism, and capitalism is in the service of a small minority of the employers, and we are the party of the employees? If you make that message clear yesterday, today, and tomorrow, then when you take a particular position on Brexit or anything else, everyone knows what you mean and where you're going. But if you don't, then you will always look as a waffler in the face of someone who says, I'm going to do this concrete thing. And then everybody wonders 2, 4, 6 years from now that with or without Brexit, the mass condition of the British working class will continue to go where it has gone under the Tories for the last many years.
So let's talk about your book, Understanding Socialism. And as you and I have talked several times over the past couple of years, socialism is experiencing a heyday among the grassroots in the United States and of course, in other countries as well. But we're very concerned, of course, with what's playing out in the U.S. with the demonization of socialism by the Republican Party, who see, you know, presidential candidate Bernie Sanders as a threat to Wall Street's corporate profits. And so this idea of socialism, which is becoming more and more popular among especially young people, embodied by someone like Sanders, is so critical for us to explore. How is your book, Understanding Socialism, different from the earlier book that we had discussed that you just put out, Understanding Marxism?
Well, socialism is a broader and bigger movement than Marxism was or is. Marxism, you might say, is the left wing of socialism. It's the more theoretically developed formulation. It's much more precise than is socialism. It's a part of the socialist movement, a crucial part, but it is a more defined, more focused kind of argument. I wrote the book Understanding Marxism because we get so many questions on my economic update program and all the other work that we do. About what is Marxism. You know, the United States is a country that's coming out of literally 75 years of virtual hibernation, like a bear in the winter, where we have been so caught up in the Cold War that a little bit like children, we decided as a nation we wouldn't teach Marxism, we wouldn't study it, and as a result, we have an entire set of generations that know little or nothing about it. And now that capitalism has shown that it is exactly the unstable, unjust, inequality-producing system that Marx, for example, worked out that it was, it's of course not surprising that a new generation, particularly young people, want to hear what this critical perspective on capitalism has to say, because they're feeling pretty critical themselves, given their student debt, given the bad jobs they're looking forward to, and all the other problems that people 35 and younger in this country have. And they have to ask me the same questions about socialism. What is different about my book is, in a sense, the timing. Socialism, like everything else in the world, changes. What it was in the 19th and 20th century, with its focus on the government taking a major role and the whole struggle between the state and the private sector, that's not what socialism in the 21st century is focused on. And most people who even are interested in socialism aren't yet aware of this, but my book tries to make that clear. The new directions of socialism, which I'm quite confident will become the defining qualities of socialism as this century progresses, is a focus not on the debate private versus state, but rather on the debate, how are we going to organize the workplace in the next century? I mean the store, the office, the factory. And the critical point there is not in the capitalist way. We are not going to do that anymore. We are going to, if we're socialists, we're going to democratize the enterprise. We're going to make it a place where democracy exists because of our belief in democracy. Instead of the peculiar way that capitalist societies did it, give us some democracy, at least the forms of it, with voting, etc., in politics, but banish it from the economy. In every enterprise, private enterprise, even government enterprise, a tiny group of people at the top, the owners, the board of directors, we all know who they are. A tiny minority make all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that all of us in our work help to create. That's an autocratic, top-down, hierarchical system, and it infects and infuses everything else in society. Us as socialists, the new direction, the revolution in the workplace, a transition from the top-down capitalist system to worker democracy, worker co-ops, one worker, one vote. We get together and decide collectively what we're going to do. We all have skin in the game. We all have a role to play. No more leaders and followers, with the followers having no control over what the leaders do. That has to end. And in that transformation, the socialist dream of doing better than capitalism can be realized. And the book explains both what were the strengths and weaknesses of the old socialism focused on the government and the strengths and problems of the new socialism focused on the transformation of the workplace.
The easy way to demonize socialism that the right often falls into is the Soviet Union and the, you know, basically regurgitating those old Cold War tropes of those who want greater government funding of basic services as somehow being akin to, you know, genocidal Stalinists. So in your book, how do you critically explain the socialism of the USSR and why today's socialism is different?
Good. It's a key question and one that we address in the book systematically and explicitly because it is addressed to us as you have obviously had it addressed to you as well. And so here's the response. Every system change, whether we went back in history to look at how slavery gave way to feudalism in Europe, or we look later on how feudalism gave way to capitalism. Here's what we see and what we apply to the transition from capitalism to socialism. It doesn't happen all at once. There isn't a one-day eureka moment when one system disappears and another one replaces it. Nothing of the sort. Out of slavery, there were many efforts to set up all kinds of systems, including feudalism. Some of them lasted a matter of days or weeks or months. Others of them lasted for years before disappearing. It took lots of trial and error and practical efforts to get beyond slavery by the people committed to the notion that you can have a society that doesn't make one group of people the property of another. Before they figured out the to-dos and the not-to-dos in order to make a general change. And the same thing happened with capitalism. There were all kinds of little capitalist efforts in feudal Europe, in the city-states of Italy, in Zurich, in Switzerland, an entrepôt area, and so on. Those efforts, early efforts, you might call them experiments in capitalism, the early ones, taught lessons of what to do and lessons of what not to do. And it took a lot of those lessons and a lot of breakdown of feudalism before the conditions were ready for a general passage from feudalism to capitalism, which is what we've done over the last three centuries. So now we come to the Soviet Union, or for that matter, China, or Cuba, or Vietnam. These are the early experiments in how to go beyond capitalism. There is no reason to expect them to be other than lessons in what we should do and likewise lessons in what we should not do. Stalinism is a lesson in what we should not do. And the economic growth rates achieved in Russia, which was the fastest growing economy in the 20th century, and the People's Republic of China, which is the fastest growing economy in the 21st century, those are lessons of what we can learn and what we need to do, strengths and weaknesses. Meanwhile, the collapse of capitalism, which is what produces the Trumps and the Johnsons of this world, continues to teach the mass of people that capitalism is a system we need to go beyond, which is why Bernie can do what he does, which is why even a Corbyn gets, you know, almost half the vote, et cetera, et cetera. The deterioration of capitalism, plus the new directions of socialism, those are the signs of exactly the kind of transition we should have expected, in which the early experiments like Russia are the difficult, painful pluses and minuses from which we learn the do's and don'ts that can take us to the next step. And I think that's the way you ought to see it. The effort of the defenders of feudalism was to point to every short lived capitalism and say, see, it can't work. Well, they were wrong. And the people who say the same thing about the implosion of Eastern Europe and Russia are making exactly the same mistake. And I think we have nothing to be ashamed of in saying, look, things happened in these early experiments that are good and are bases to build on, and things happened that we must not allow to be repeated. Exactly those decisions were made by the people who pushed capitalism out of feudalism. The French Revolution took care of its enemies with the guillotine. That was not because capitalism requires guillotines. It was because in those conditions, at that time, that's what they did, and they learned to do otherwise. And the people who are socialists, very acutely aware of what went wrong, whether it's in China or Russia or Cuba or Vietnam, because those mistakes cannot be allowed to repeat because the socialist project is threatened by them.
How important is it to discuss democratic control when discussing socialism? Because that's another easy target that the critics of socialism often lob, which is that if you want socialism, you basically advocate for so much government control that it leads to authoritarianism. Of course, they never discuss the erosion of our democracy under capitalism. but when we talk about socialism, the critical component of democratic control and a democratic transition to socialist government, how important is that?
Well, I think it loses importance literally by the hour. Most Americans, you know, no longer work in a little business, in a small business. The bulk of our employed class is working for all the giants whose letter names, IBM, GE, and all that we all know. And in those corporations that do all the bulk of the business in this country, you have an absolute dictatorship. I mean, take General Motors. Not that you would pick it out, but it's as good an example as any. 100,000 workers or whatever they have now, and a board of directors of 18 people. Those 18 people make all the decisions. The 100,000 live with the results. You close a factory in Ohio and open one in Shanghai. They make the decision, those 18. You lose your job. Your family loses an income. Your community loses a taxpayer. All of the ways that modern big corporations, mega corporations work is a rigid, absolute dictatorship of a tiny number. To listen to those people criticize socialism for doing what they do is laughable, and most Americans are beginning to get that message. But even more than that, I think there's a grain of truth to that criticism, which is one of the reasons why socialism in the 21st century is focused on democratizing the workplace, whether it's a government enterprise run by some officials or a private enterprise run by a board of directors elected by shareholders. It doesn't matter for the socialism of the 21st century, because either way, the issue for socialism is that all the employees together, one person, one vote, democratically decide what the enterprise will do. Because the person taking the risk in an enterprise is not just the investor and not just the inventor of the product. It's also all the people who have taken a job there, who've moved their family, who've enrolled their kid in a local school, who need that job. And yet the difference between the two, those at the top can shape and decide how the enterprise they've risked to invest in works. But the mass of employees take the risk and have no control. I think the demand to democratize the enterprise is not only the direction of socialism, but will make it an effective, attractive alternative for the mass of working people in both state capitalist and private capitalist institutions, and therefore is going to be a very powerful contesting force in the years ahead.
Well, Richard, finally, I'm wondering whether you have any reflections on the state of our current electoral situation. We started our conversation talking about what happened in Britain with their election, and we have a massive election next year in the United States in 2020, primary elections coming up as early as March. And the conversation around socialism versus preserving the current order doesn't just play out between the two parties, but plays out, of course, within the Democratic Party as well. And looks like currently the socialist, self-described socialist, is gaining ground, and that's Bernie Sanders. I hesitate to be optimistic, but what do you think?
Yes, I think you're quite right. I don't think you should hesitate to be optimistic. I think what Mr. Bernie Sanders has accomplished already in 2016, when the early predictions were he'd get 1 to 2% of the Democratic primary votes, terribly mistaken. Again, the predictions that he could go nowhere, once again mistaken. Look, time is on the side of the socialists. The people for whom the word socialist is a bad word are the people raised, born, and bred in the Cold War. That Cold War is behind us. And it, no matter how hard the older folks and the conservative folks want to hold on to that way of thinking, time is working against them. On the other hand, for young people who were promised the so-called American dream but can't afford it or even the education to try to get it, it's clear that capitalism works for the 1%, maybe for 5%, but not for most of them. And for them, socialism is becoming more attractive and more interesting, literally, with the passage of every day. And that's one of the reasons why we wrote this book, because unlike other books, this is a book written for the audience that is already there. And therefore, it is, in a sense, an attempt to participate in, to help develop and grow and make more sophisticated and politically astute the people already in motion around Bernie Sanders, around Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the growing number of people that are determined to prove that we can do better than capitalism, just like we could progress beyond slavery and feudalism. That process of progress hasn't stopped. Capitalism isn't the end of history. We're just at the beginning.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your insight and good luck with the new book.
Thank you very much, Sonali, and my appreciation to voices like yours that have helped create the very audience we're speaking of.
My guest has been Richard Wolff. He's a visiting professor at the New School University in New York, professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books. The one that he wrote right before this latest was Understanding Marxism, and his latest book is Understanding Socialism. Richard is also the host of Economic Update. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.